Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. And welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on New Books in Intellectual History, we have Dr. Anjali Vats, who's an associate professor of communication and African diaspora studies and associate professor of law by courtesy at Boston College. Dr. Vats is the author of The Color of Creatorship, Intellectual Property, Race, and the Making of Americans, published by Stanford University Press in 2020. Welcome to the show, Dr. Vats.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here today.
You're welcome, and thank you for agreeing to do this interview. The Color of Creatorship is a complex intellectual property history that examines how copyright, trademark, and patent discourses shape American ideas about race, nation, and citizenship. First, we will discuss Dr. Vats' biography and some thoughts on intellectual history in general, and then we will engage in a more detailed discussion of her book, The Color of Creatorship. Dr. Vats, please tell us some more about your educational background, teaching, and research interests, or whatever you'd like us to know about your journey as a scholar.
Awesome. That's a great place to start. I like to tell the story that I ended up writing about intellectual property and race by trying to avoid writing about race. And what I learned was that intellectual property, much like many other things in the world, is very deeply embedded with histories of race, that it's not a space that is free from those histories. So how does that relate to my background? Well, I started out after I finished my bachelor's degree at Michigan State University. I went to Emory Law School. And at Emory, I had the opportunity to do some civil rights work. I thought I was going to do civil rights and international human rights work. But I ended up on an intellectual property moot court team, which I really enjoyed. And so I started studying intellectual property. And then I went on to do a master's in intellectual property law and policy at the University of Washington, and I clerked for a couple of years. And at that point, I didn't really have a plan to study race. I thought that I was going to practice intellectual property law. But in a turn of events, I decided to go back for my PhD because I really missed teaching. So what ended up happening was that I got my PhD at the University of Washington in communication. And during that time, I had the opportunity to study race and rhetoric. And so this book is really a culmination of all those interests wrapped into one. I was able to really start to see and crystallize some of the ways that race manifests in the context of intellectual property law.
So very interesting that you say you came by way of the study of the law in law school. And my field is intellectual history, and this channel is intellectual history. So it's very interdisciplinary a field for the historian. And so my next question is about your thoughts about intellectual history, because this is a history. I mean, you take us through several, really the whole compendium of intellectual property law. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about intellectual history in general, or how would you describe it?
Absolutely. So for me, you know, I think intellectual histories are really about tracing where ideas come from and how they're formed in social and cultural and political spaces. I will say that I did not set out necessarily to write an intellectual history of intellectual property law. I didn't even necessarily set out to write a history, and I don't claim to be a historian by training. But what I found when I started this project was that I had to do some self-orientation. There are a number of fabulous scholars that have written about race and intellectual property, folks like Madhavi Sundar and Keith Aoki, K.J. Green. I could go on naming them. The thing that I wasn't really getting was a big picture of where these ideas came from. So what I set out to do was to trace those ideas to their origins. And I thought that would help me understand what the foundations of intellectual property law were, but that then turned into the whole book in and of itself. So that was really an interesting thing. I think I can call myself an accidental historian in that sense. And for me, intellectual history in this context is really about trying to understand how we got the intellectual property laws we got and where they came from and how they have been or not been intertwined with conversations about race and whiteness since the formation of the nation.
Right. It's a history, but it's more than a history because you're looking at, I mean, so many facets of intellectual property law. At one point, you're looking at the motion picture business. You're looking at the music industry over just a broad sweep of historical time. It's just, I think it is an astounding feat. As a text that moves into so many different areas of American life. You mentioned race and critical race theory, and this will be up to you. It wasn't one of our official questions, but avoiding the discussion of race. But critical race theory has been in the news of late, particularly with our current president attempting to erase the discussion of critical race theory. Can you tell us more about how critical race theory informs this particular work of yours?
Absolutely. And I'm happy to speak to the Trump element of this as well, or number 45, as some people prefer to call him. I started reading critical race theory when I was in college. I was probably 20 years old, 19 years old. I came to post-colonial theory first. I remember reading my first Spivak and then moving into the work of folks like Derrick Bell. I think it's important that folks understand what critical race theory is and why it emerged. Critical race theory is a movement that emerged in the Legal Academy first, and it was really a response to the rollback of civil rights that happened in the post-civil rights moment. So in the 1970s with the rollback of busing, and in the 70s and 80s with the refusal of broad affirmative action laws. One of the things that came with that rollback was this notion of colorblindness and also this acceleration of the idea of reverse racism. So, you know, I think that President Trump wants to package critical race theory as this threatening anti-white idea because we're in a kind of nationalist, populist, white nationalist moment, right? That's what I mean to say with nationalist. But that's not what it is at all. Really, it was a response by legal scholars, folks like Derrick Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw, Angela Harris. These were folks that were really trying to make a place for people of color in the legal academy. And they were really trying to understand how we had managed to have this moment of civil rights revolution and then how that moment was not really playing out in equality for Black and brown people in the country. So when I think about critical race theory, I do not think of the things that Trump raises in terms of, you know, threat to whiteness. What I think about is how critical race theory helps Black and brown people understand the American politics around race and why those politics came to be and how they are structurally embedded within our legal institutions.
Right. As you mentioned, this history of ideas, it's part of this long history, I would even say, of ideas in terms of critical theory, Enlightenment tradition, and all of those things quote, unfold over time in a larger history of ideas and this, you know, reaction to what was happening, you know, in the post-civil rights moment. So I think the tool of the history of ideas helps us get at some of these questions we're faced with at the present.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. If we look back from the Enlightenment, and I address this in the last chapters of the book, if we look back to the Enlightenment really sets the stage for liberalism. It sets the stage for how we understand progress. It also sets the stage for how we understand humanness in a lot of ways in contemporary society. So I think you're right on to say that this goes as far back as the Enlightenment. And I want to flag that critical race theory is really an interdisciplinary area of study. So critical race theory comes to be in conversation with the radical ethnic studies, departments and programs that are being formed in the post-civil rights moment. And I think it is in conversation with Black studies, with Asian American studies. I could, I could list more areas that critical race theory now sort of cross-pollinates with. But yeah, I think those are all embedded together, as you point out.
So I want to get, I guess we can continue on discussion about race and this term you use in the introduction, early part of the book, racial scripts, and it's applied in your study. What is meant by the term, and can you give us a concrete example of racial scripts?
Absolutely. The idea of racial scripts comes from the work of Natalia Molina, who's an American studies scholar. And Molina, I love it when the race scholars win big awards. So she just won a MacArthur Fellowship. There's known as the Genius Grants. So I hope that people will take up this idea of racial scripts more broadly. But what Molina is talking about when she's talking about racial scripts is she is trying to point us to how race can become and racial stereotypes can become comparative and overlapping. So that's to say that if we have a negative stereotype or a negative framing of one racial group, that idea then becomes available to us to use against other groups. The example I'll give is actually not in the intellectual property context, because I think we'll move on to the intellectual property argument. But I think a more accessible argument that she makes and other scholars write about is the birther movement. So if we think about the idea of birther rhetorics are really they really originate as anti-immigrant rhetorics that are targeted at Latinx people. What we see in the moment when President Obama is elected is that Trump tries to mobilize birther rhetorics against Obama. So what's happening there is an application of this anti-Mexican, anti-immigrant rhetoric, the mobilization of that in a way that produces anti-Blackness against Obama and anti-Asianness, right, to the extent that we think about the rhetorics around Hawaii and how they get mobilized, right? So what we end up with Obama, I think, is a really interesting portrayal of him through the lens of birther rhetorics that then become racist against other groups of people. So they're more easy to mobilize. And we can start to see how these racist ideas are applied more broadly, and they move between racial groups as opposed to being confined to one racial group.
Yeah, that's a good good example. I was thinking about, as you said, that 18th century, where Ben Franklin is using the term aliens, and he's leveling this phrase against the Germans who are overrunning, the Pennsylvania colony. And he says, what are we going to do? What will become of the English? And he uses the word aliens to refer to the Scots, Irish, and German immigrants who are, he claims, overrunning the colony. So that word alien then gets used again and again.
Absolutely.
Is a part of a script that makes a lot of sense. So let's get more deeply into your book. And I love that title, by the way, The Color of Creatorship. Like,
Thank you. It does
such a great job of conveying what you're arguing here. But what are some of the early historical examples of how intellectual property law was organized or operationalized to protect the intellectual property interests of whites in the early republic?
That's a great question. The way that I approach this study, I just want to take a step back for a moment and talk about how I use racial scripts in the book. What I'm really interested in is how racial scripts got created through the first Copyright, Patent, and Trademark Acts in the United States, and then how that language maybe didn't get used in exactly the same way, but served as a sort of word bank, an idea bank for racist dog whistles over time, even in these laws that seem like they're racially neutral. So how does it protect white people? Well, I think in the early republic, this is a really straightforward exclusionary problem. Critical race theorists talk about the difference between formal exclusion and the difference between de jure discrimination and de facto discrimination. What's happening in the early republic is that white people and particularly white men are really trying to reserve intellectual property rights through the language of citizenship. So they structure the protection of intellectual property rights around the idea of citizenship. The earliest Copyright Act in 1790 and then the Patent Act as well, they use this language of citizenship. And that gets liberalized over time to include citizens and residents. But the take home here is that only citizens and residents could own intellectual property or register intellectual property. So what that means in practice is that there is a literal formal disenfranchisement of Black and brown people. And this is why we have conversations about how Black people, for instance, were inventing, even though they didn't necessarily own patents from that time. So one of the ways that creatorship then gets that cast as fundamentally white is through this formal exclusion through the language of citizenship and residency.
Yeah, this is, the point about the creator, creatorship, the creator is white. And it makes me also think about incidents, you are demonstrating this is a continuum. You know, over time, the creator is white, the person who infringes versus the creator and so on. And how makes me think of like Du Bois and discussion about there's no language for Black genius.
Mm-hmm.
There's no script for Black genius.
Mm-hmm.
The only script there is a racial one, and it degrades, folks of color and Blackness in particular. So there's no, it's making, your book is making me think about how then there's no language for Black genius. And I was had a conversation about the show Jeopardy with someone,
mm-hmm.
and how that show helps to construct the idea, I think, of the white genius, right? Mm-hmm. Person with knowledge. In terms of who's on the show, who's constantly winning the show, and who's invited to come on. And it just made me think about, kind of an aside, but your book is making me think about that. And so give us some more detail about this notion. You use this phrase, the intellectual property citizen. And you already have told us that there is this connection to notions of citizenship, creator, and citizenship in the early republic. Tell us some more about that.
Absolutely. I actually don't think your Jeopardy point is incidental. I love that you're making that Jeopardy point, because I don't know if you've seen the petition for LeVar Burton to be the next host of Jeopardy.
I heard some conversation about that. And I told my friend he will never be because that's not what that show's about.
Well, it's an interesting question, right? Relating to that idea of citizenship or of creatorship that you're mentioning, that goes back to Du Bois. Because, you know, there's this whole conversation about Black nerds that I won't dive into right now. But yeah, I mean, I think that this goes back to what you were saying about Enlightenment ideas and the history of ideas. I think we have to ask the question of how far back we have to go to find the origin point, right, or the lack of conversation about Black genius. Like, how embedded is that in our ideas of civilization, of enlightenment, of progress, and so on? And the answer for me is that it's very deeply embedded. So when I'm talking about the intellectual property citizen, what I'm trying to do is create what Michel Foucault would call a grid of intelligibility, or a kind of schema for understanding how race is organized within the context of intellectual property. And what that means is I am interested in how the language of citizenship not only formally anchors whiteness in the beginning of the Republic, but also how implicit notions of citizenship, i.e. who is a good intellectual property citizen and who is a bad intellectual property citizen, become forces that affect the outcome of intellectual property cases. I think that citizenship also becomes what Marufasan would call a prudential characterization. So often, law and society scholars, or, you know, folks that are doing cultural studies of law, will talk about how law is a place of narrative negotiation. That law isn't just is a set of rules that's handed down from above, but we tell stories in law.
Right.
And when we tell stories, there are certain people that we find to be more sympathetic and other people that we don't find to be sympathetic. So part of what I think citizenship does is it helps us to understand how, in the context of intellectual property cases, some people appear to courts to be sympathetic and some people don't appear to be sympathetic. And that's very much connected, I argue, with the way that we treat citizenship and have treated citizenship, and also this idea of humanness, who is and isn't human.
Right, sure. And like you said, we take it back to the Enlightenment, thinking about George Hegel's On History. And basically in that, he says there's nothing in Africa. Africa has nothing to offer. And here he is writing this, you know, laying the groundwork for this notion that these are folks without, you know, without thought and without humanity. And amid the backdrop of, you know, Atlantic slave trade and so on. But so if we turn our attention then to racial liberalism in the 20th century and the changes in intellectual property law, continuities and discontinuities, I guess. So in the second chapter, as your book unfolds, you begin to talk about racial liberalism in the 20th century. So what impact does it have on intellectual property law, the emergence of racial liberalism? Do things get better for the people of color in generally, or?
Yeah, I think the answer to this question is deeply related to what the critical race theorists are talking about. So let me take a step back here to give listeners a sense of what the architecture of the book is. Really, I'm moving through intellectual property law. I use that phrase, intellectual property law, and I gesture to critiques of that term, because really that's a term that includes a whole bunch of stuff that isn't a bunch of bodies of law that aren't necessarily related to each other in their purpose or source and so on. But the areas of intellectual property law that I'm interested in the book are copyright, patent, and trademark law. And I trace their histories over approximately, from the late 1700s to the end of the Obama administration. And what I am interested in is not necessarily demarcating exact points in history where we start to think about intellectual property citizenship differently, but to demarcate eras and trend lines in how we approach the idea of creatorship. So what I do is I ended up, as I was reading through intellectual property cases, I was able to find these anchoring themes that for me really helped me to understand and conceptualize how race could continue to organize each of these areas of intellectual property law. So in the context of copyright, what I found was that there's this persistent idea of true imagination versus infringement or copying or a kind of uninspired creatorship, and that idea of true imagination is racialized. In the context of patent law, the analog was human progress. So I was able to trace over time who in copyright or in patent cases was and wasn't imagined to be an agent of human progress. And then the last was in the context of trademark law. And I, in a play on Laura Mulvey's work, looked at the white male consumer gaze and how it structures trademarks, right? And we're talking about trademarks now because Aunt Jemima and so on. So there was that great SNL skit the other night about the trademarks getting fired, right? How does this relate to liberalism? Well, we talked, you and I just talked about citizenship, right? This era of formal exclusion. Liberalism is really about this rights-based notion that if we create rights that are equal and colorblind and accessible to all people, then we will solve the race problem in America. And what I find in the context of intellectual property is that even though we have intellectual property laws in copyright, trademark, and patent law that look like they're facially neutral, they still discriminate against groups of people. So I look at a variety of cases that demonstrate that. One of those sets of cases has to do with sampling and also parody, right? So what does that look like in the context of race liberalism? And how do we both gesture to a universal expansion of these rights while at the same time continuing to create a kind of unequal citizenship or unequal allocation of those rights?
One of the cases you noticed, the Decca Records case in 1950, and the notion of white distinctiveness in this case in particular. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure, absolutely. Supreme Records versus Decca Records is an interesting case because it involves a line of cases in unfair competition law that really define the directions of copyright law. So you have a white artist who makes a cover of the work of a black artist, and the distinctiveness problem that comes up here. So the judge concludes, Judge Duffy concludes, that there is not actually any unfair competition here. That's in part because of who owns the actual composition to the song. But what ends up happening is you can see the judge kind of going through and talking about the lack of artistry in the context of this race record so to speak, that this Black artist has recorded. So this is, I think, characteristic of the way that courts ungenerously read Black creativity over time, and is also emblematic of how courts tend to overestimate white achievement. So this is a case in which the white artist's work is somehow more polished and more creative and more worthy of artistic protection than the Black artists. And I think that's a trend that we see throughout the history of music, jazz, of hip hop, and so on, that we continually see courts protecting white creation, even when Black and brown people are being extremely creative. So sampling, we can say a lot of things about sampling, but that sampling is not creative is not, in my opinion, one of them.
Right. It's a hallmark of Black music. Think about the DeBarge song that gets sampled so many times, A Dream. It's used on almost every major hip hop record, and repetition is, intrinsic to Black cultural production, and it makes me think also about the case of the Beatles and Chuck Berry, and how, Revolution is not an original song, Come Together is not either, but the Beatles are on a pedestal. They didn't rip anybody off. This is innovation.
Right. Absolutely. I think that history of music is so important to trace and think about, because it is the site of so much negotiation in American history, racial negotiation. I start and end the book with Blurred Lines because that's, I think, such a complicated case in many ways. But there are these moments, and you're pointing to them, where, before Bismarcky got sued by Gilbert O'Sullivan, these cases of sampling were largely dealt with outside of court. They largely involved settling cases quietly and adding someone to the liner notes. You talk about sampling. One of the famous cases of sampling is of the song Funky Drummer. And that song Funky Drummer gets sampled, but there's no protection for the Black artist. There's no protection for the rhythm, for the repetition. And so there are these intangible elements of creation that copyright law willfully refuses to protect, rhythm, repetition, etc. And for a long time, music had to be written down. And these are all ways of structurally disadvantaging Black artists. So when Bismarcky comes along, he samples some of Gilbert O'Sullivan's work. And one of the things I like to joke about is how good Bismarcky was for Gilbert O'Sullivan, because the same people are not listening to that music. And not only are the same people not listening to that music, but way more people listen to Gilbert O'Sullivan now because they have to teach this copyright case, right? So he should be thanking Bismarcky, but instead what happens is that Bismarcky gets pulled into court, and the judge starts this opinion, and this is in 1991, if I'm remembering correctly. The judge starts the opinion with "Thou shalt not steal." Wow. And then recommends criminal penalties, which had never been a thing before. So I think we can, you started with this question of Supreme Records versus Decca Records, but we can see this idea of white distinctiveness playing out over and over and over again in the context of music and copyright.
Sure, absolutely. I definitely can just think of songs now. And when I heard Blurred Lines, as soon as that song came on, I said, that's Marvin Gaye.
Uh-huh.
As soon as it came on the radio, I was like, oh, I guess, the state allowed them to use it, and then it unfolds in this, legal case.
Totally. Sometimes when it comes on, I'm like, which song are we listening to right now?
Right. It was so obvious anyway to me.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, some of these questions we probably may not get to, but that's okay. It's, I think it's a good conversation. Let's move forward a little bit and look at the Obama administration and intellectual property law, intellectual property policy and changes in the law. Do we see, this is the post-racial moment. Mm-hmm. Do we see more of the same or, you know, what is actually different under the Obama administration? Or is it much the changing same, you know, the same script?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I want to preface this by saying I have an extraordinary amount of respect for Barack Obama. He, in many ways, did the impossible. I think he is a brilliant man. I also think he was severely constrained in his role as president. You know, he's the first Black man in the White House, and that meant there were certain things he could not say until, mm-hmm. you know, the end of his second term, which I really enjoyed second term, end of second term Obama, because I think he said some things that he wanted to say for a long time. I think for a lot of Obama's presidency, though, he is maybe not embracing post-racial rhetoric, but is at the very least suggesting that we live in a world with a level playing field, and that there is access for Black and brown people in areas of inventorship, in areas of copyright law, and so on. So there's a contrast that I draw in the chapter on what I call post-racial creatorship. And that is that at home we have Obama, or domestically we have Obama, talking about how anybody can become a creator. He gives this speech when he signs the America Invents Act, and he's like, anybody can become a creator. Except then he invokes a lineage of white creators. He talks about Thomas Jefferson, and we didn't talk about this at the beginning, but Thomas Jefferson was one of the people in the early Republic that was like, Black people lack true imagination. He was talking about Phyllis Wheatley, and they shouldn't be citizens. So here we have Obama, who is telling us anybody can become an inventor, but also invoking these really problematic narratives of some of the founding fathers of the nation that definitely didn't think that. And at the same time that he's doing that domestically, internationally, he is also promoting intellectual property policies that are labeling Chinese people, Indian people, etc., as infringers. So what we see, I think, in the post-racial era in this Obama moment is that domestically we are circulating this discourse about that really functionally ends up being post-racial, that functionally is the idea that anybody, if they are able to be entrepreneurial enough, can achieve the American dream. While internationally, there's this really intense, what I call hyper-racial discourse, where the United States is attacking people of color that maybe have different development trajectories or different values around intellectual property. So I think in many ways, Obama is more of the same. Because the actual laws haven't become more accessible from the race liberal period, but his narrative about the laws is changing. And a lot of the racial, the racist ideas, I guess, and the racial ideas in the United States are getting projected internationally at Asia and other places that we imagine to have infringers.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, the language of the post-racial language, you find it with Michelle Obama and Becoming too. But you also see they both placing a greater emphasis on the individual. Obama is, I would say, is engaging in kind of these racial scripts or narratives when he goes to the Black church and he says, you know, tells Black men, you know, get off the couch, go get a job, you know, almost as if, you know, it's all on you to go out and be responsible. He gets criticized for that. So, I mean, as somebody trained in the law, you would think, I mean, I mean, you have more hope, right? That he's aware because he's also a trained lawyer, but at the same time, trading some in some of these same racial scripts. And recently with his latest book that came out, basically saying, you know, Trump was elected because it was a backlash against my presidency. And he's being dragged on Twitter right now about that comment. So there's maybe with him some blind spots in looking at the racial landscape.
Yeah. You know, I was reading that an excerpt from his new book last night. The Atlantic published an excerpt of it, and it just got me thinking again, you know, what his rhetorical options were. And I do, on the one hand, yes, you know, I think a lot of people wanted Obama to know better and do better. And that's a super fair critique, in my opinion, of him. On the flip side, I have a little bit of compassion as well, because you know, it's hard to get up there and go full on Derek Bell. I think that he was in a position where he couldn't necessarily do that. And I think he's right that the Trump administration is white lash. And, you know, Dr. King famously wrote about white lash. The Obama administration is in a tough spot with respect to race. I don't agree with embracing individualism and this sort of post-racial politic as a way out. I do think, though, that he had a limited number of options.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I think my concern about him and Michelle is, you know, do they really believe this? Like, yeah. Because we won't know, right, until their private letters and so on are released.
Totally. I want to hope they don't. I do.
Right. I mean, that's kind of all we have until we actually get the archival material.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as we get closer to wrapping up here, I want to ask you this question about towards the end of your book in the last chapter. You talk about that creators of color resisted or fought back against racialist narratives and intellectual property law. And, you know, who were they or how and to what extent were they successful? I know you use the example of Prince, and which is another interesting case. Where he tried to reclaim his rights to his music and changed his name. So maybe elaborate a little bit.
Yeah. I like talking about Prince. I actually, this is developing into its own project. Prince is developing into his own project. So the argument that I'm making in the context here of copyright law goes back to some of what you were saying at the beginning, when you were talking about Du Bois and the lack of frameworks for Black genius. A lot of the work that Prince does is to create language and space, cultural space, for talking about Black genius. I want to be clear that I don't think he is the only artist that did this. I don't think that he is the only musician that did this. I think that the Love Symbol controversy, though, is a really productive moment for thinking about the navigational space that Black artists have in the world. Prince had a lot of latitude with Warner Brothers. So he signed his first contract with Warner Brothers when he was in his teens, late teens, and he had a lot of creative control compared to other artists. And with that creative control, you know, he was able to produce some of the albums that we know and love. He hit a speed bump in the 90s, though, and I was in my teens at the time. And my recollection of it is that in the moment, people were like, why is Prince changing his name to this symbol? What is happening right now, you know? And then he appeared for some time with the word slave on his face. Well, in this posthumous moment, I think people are looking back and saying, oh, the thing that Prince was doing actually was genius, because he was pushing back against what Warner Brothers was imposing on him. He was making a sort of labor protest, and he was also critiquing the way that Black artists have been exploited in the music industry. So by doing that, he was able to call attention to the idea of Black creatorship as a category in the world. He was also able to call attention to a number of ways that the Black people historically have been oppressed in the United States. So for me, the symbol reads as invoking critiques of sound recordings not being protectable. So if we look back at the reasons that Black artists weren't protected, one reason was that they couldn't write down their sheet music. And right. they couldn't read and write, right? Because they were structurally disenfranchised in that way. So you had white producers and white managers taking advantage of these Black artists. So there's a lot of ways, I think, to read the symbol, but I think you can read it as, you know, as symbolic of the X that a lot of Black artists signed their names with before they could read and write. In this period before sound recordings were protected, I think you can read it as resonance with Malcolm X. And I think you can read this whole performance as a critique of the way that ownership structures work in the music industry. One of Prince's great battles toward the second half of his life was owning his master records. And he has this great quote where he says, if you don't own your masters own you. He's one of the first artists that really pushes for owning master records. And that is a copyright question. That's a question of who has the ability to make money from your compositions. So Prince really stands for me for the creation of what Molina would call counterscripts. He stands for me for the creation of new narratives of Black genius. He also stands for me for a critique of the way that ownership regimes work in the context of intellectual property law. And, you know, the 1619 Project did this great episode on music. And that episode, I think, sonically shows us how much theft has happened in the context of Black music. And Prince is like, no, we're not going to do this anymore. You know, we're gonna talk about these labor politics. We're going to talk about ownership. And we're going to talk about copyright and exploitation.
Yeah, I would also say, just to kind of wrap it up, I think Prince also, I mean, he played 27 instruments. He's this example of Black genius that there's no language for, that he's asserting himself as a creator and a creative genius, really, I think. So, Dr. Vatz, as we wrap things up, tell us about your next work or your current scholarship, some current research projects you're working on.
Sure. I am continuing down this road of race and intellectual property. I gestured toward one of those, the projects. I'm working on two book projects right now, sort of simultaneously. In fits and starts. So one of them is actually taking a look at Prince's contributions to intellectual property more generally. I, in The Color of Creatorship, look at his copyright interventions. What I learned in doing the research for that book was that Prince actually made contributions in other areas of intellectual property as well. So I am writing a book that focuses on Prince and intellectual property rights and his contributions to, say, rights of publicity, to copyright law, to patent law, and so on. So that's the first project I'm working on. The second project actually takes a look at race in the hospitality industry, and in particular in the cocktail industry. So I don't know, that project is a lot less far along, but I think it's going in the direction of taking a look at social media, how Black and brown bartenders and bar owners are able to leverage social media to create social justice conversations. And then also a look into how branding works in that space. So, you know, trademark law is a body of law, but it is also a lived practiced, performed experience of brands. And I'm interested in how that can be negotiated in digital spaces here in the context of hospitality.
Oh, very interesting. It sounds just fascinating, especially I look forward to reading your work, your book on prints. Well, Dr. Vats, we have taken up enough of your time this afternoon, but I want to thank you for participating in this interview about your important book, The Color of Creatorship.
I so appreciate it. This was super fun. And thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. You're welcome.